Hello, I'm Stuart Nullman. This is number 0229, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0229. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Erin Murphy, who is best known for playing young Tabitha on Bewitched, a job she started when she was just 2 years old.
Some of my earliest memories in my life were being on the set. I mean, I don't really know where it started. And I think a lot of the memories are triggered from watching the show, but I stayed on it until we went off the air when I was 8. So I have lots and lots of memories from the set.
Brian Toohey is the author of Larceny Games, Sports Gambling, Game Fixing, and the FBI.
What I found I thought was rather shocking is in the course of about 20 years or so, the FBI conducted well over 400 investigations into game fixing here in the United States, and that covered horse racing, boxing, college sports, and the NFL, the NBA, and Major League Baseball. And when you consider that the NFL, for example, says we've never had a game fixed ever, I think this information that the FBI possessed would say otherwise.
Peter Franklin, the Gabby Cabby, shares a slice of the Big Apple from his yellow mobile conveyance lounge.
Some artist lady was given $5,000 by the city. She made a statue of a man being hugged by a bear, and as a result of that, he has an erection. Now, I'm not quite sure into what category of art that goes, but so now here we spent $5,000 to get that statue, which is in a New York City public park.
And of course, there's lots and lots and lots of stuff and an idiot of the day. The guest Slater, the person who told you this was show number 0229, was our old friend Stuart Nullman, the host of Book Banter on this very show. Thank you very much, Stu, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. We'll touch base with Stuart on next week's edition of the Stuff File program. Right now, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Well, in this day and age, I actually find it amazing that the so-called Nigerian inheritance scam is still capable of fooling people, you know, educated people, people who should definitely know better. Iowa lawyer Robert Allen Wright Jr. was suspended for a year by the Attorney Disciplinary Board in December for mishandling clients' funds. One client had received a Nigerian inheritance letter in 2011, and Wright apparently jumped at the opportunity to receive $18 million, seemingly unaware that almost everyone else in the developed world knows about unsolicited Nigerian business deals. Well, by December of 2013, just last month, Wright had looted accounts of other clients in order to pay the fees, and I'm doing air quotes here, necessary to free up the $18 million bucks. He was spared a more onerous punishment only because the board concluded that Wright honestly continues to believe that the inheritance is real and that one day a trunk full of $100 bills is going to appear upon his office doorstep. This guy is as thick as a board, you know? Now that this story is out, you have to ask, who is more gullible? This idiot lawyer who still thinks that all this money is in his future, or anybody who hires this clown as a lawyer a year from now when his suspension ends? That's what I want to know. And you know, I got very, very close to making this guy the idiot of the day, but I didn't. That comes later. Meanwhile, a man robbed by two men in New York's Central Park said they returned his cell phone when the outdated gadget apparently failed to meet their standards. Kevin Cook, one of the two men robbed by the duo shortly after midnight on Saturday, said one mugger displayed a gun and said he would shoot the victims if they made any noise. The robbers took a cell phone, a briefcase, and a wallet containing about $114 in cash. But Cook said one of the robbers gave him back his phone. He just took a look at it and didn't recognize it at all. I just assumed that he couldn't make any money off of it, so he handed it back to me, and a minute later, I was able to call 911 and get the whole thing started, Cook said. Cook also said there turned out to be an upside to his outdated 2010 LG Quantum. It's like, finally, a pro for having something out of date, he said. Yeah. You see, this is just one of the reasons, one of the myriad of reasons, why I still have a flip phone. I'm not kidding. I do. I'd get a rotary cell phone if I could. Anyway, moving right along, South Carolina authorities say a 44-year-old woman angry at a man for returning home without beer on Christmas beat and stabbed him with a ceramic squirrel. The Charleston County Sheriff's Office said in a report that deputies found a man covered with blood when they arrived at Helen Williams' North Charleston home. She told investigators the man fell and cut himself, but couldn't explain why her hands and clothes were also bloody. Deputies say the man said Williams was so angry when he returned without beer, because stores were closed on Christmas Eve, that she grabbed a ceramic squirrel, beat him in the head, and then stabbed him in the chest and shoulder. Williams was charged with criminal domestic violence. It wasn't known if she had a lawyer. The squirrel did not survive intact. Well, so much for holiday cheer. Wow, if this is the way she acts when she can't get her beer, just imagine what it must be like to be around her when she's had a few. Yikes. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, here's another winning lady for you in this Stuff File newscast. Okay, this is a lovely New Year's Eve story for you, because we had a Christmas story just now, so this is New Year's Eve. This one comes from Boston, where apparently lesbians and heterosexuals still haven't learned to get along. This particular New Year's Eve party got so out of hand that one woman's toe was bitten off. According to police, the host of the party became upset when the victim, the soon-to-be nine-toed lesbian, and by the way, nine-toed lesbian sounds like the great name for a punk rock band, doesn't it? Anyway, this soon-to-be nine-toed lesbian told her about an altercation with a male partier around 3 a.m., accusing her of ruining the party, the female host punched the woman repeatedly until the victim attempted to flee. They then continued the altercation in the street. Having wrestled one another to the ground, the fight ended in gruesome fashion when the host bit off the little toe of the victim's left foot. A friend of the victim drove her to the Boston Medical Center for treatment. Officers received a call from the hospital at around 5 a.m. and reporting an assault and battery. Detectives are investigating the incident, which left both women with scratches on their arms. The victim, whose name has not been released, also had scratches to her forehead, chest, and neck. The cause of the initial fight was the victim approached the man's girlfriend and asked her if she would like to, quote, hook up, unquote. He grabbed her around the neck before releasing her, and that's how this whole altercation began with the host and the lesbian. Anyway, just another happy holiday story. I guess alcohol must have been somehow involved. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on this week's edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? The name Aaron Murphy might not ring a lot of bells unless you're a true fan of classic television, but almost everybody knows who you're talking about when you say the name Tabitha. It was Aaron who played the adorable toddler witch of Samantha and Darren on the hit TV series Bewitched. So, what has Aaron Murphy been up to? Well, quite a lot, it turns out, so let's find out. Aaron joins us on the line right now from California. Hi, Aaron.
Hi.
Thanks for being on the program with us.
Of course, I'm happy to be here.
You started on that show at the tender age of, if I'm not mistaken, 2, is that correct?
I started right before I turned 2, yes.
So, at what point were you, I mean, what's your earliest memory of the show?
Some of my earliest memories in my life were being on the set. I mean, I don't really know where it started. And I think a lot of the memories are triggered from watching the show, but I stayed on it until we went off the air when I was 8. So I have lots and lots of memories from the set.
Now, as I said in the introduction, you have done a lot. You have been very, very busy. You've been a model. You've done commercials. You're a teacher, an acting teacher. You've been a television producer, casting director, a motivational speaker. The list goes on and on and on. Would you say you're a type A personality?
I would definitely say that. I think it's like a shark. You have to keep moving or you die.
the show ended when you were 8 years old. But again, you did go on and stay in acting beyond that. We often hear about the pitfalls that children go through as actors. How did you avoid that?
I think you hear about pitfalls that everybody goes through. I think it's a lot more publicized when it's someone famous who gets in trouble for doing something rather than just somebody you went to elementary school with. I think very early on I took responsibility for my own decisions, and I kind of took the idea that I was a role model seriously. And I don't know, I think everything that I have done wrong in my life, I certainly wouldn't blame it on being a child actor.
I've had a chance to talk to several child actors, and they are dividedly into two camps. Now, you have six children, correct?
I do.
So this is the question I always ask. Would you let your kids be child actors?
I would. I would. I've said it for years and years. I said it back when I had only one child. And I always think that as a parent, you kind of support and nurture whatever your kids are interested in. So, I mean, none of my kids have ever said they were interested in acting. I mean, they enjoy the perks of my acting, and they like going to some of the fun events we go to. But I think as a parent, you kind of, I don't know, you guide them to make good decisions, but you kind of let them, you know, make their own path and decide what they want to do.
At the age of two, how did this all begin for you? Did you show an interest in pointing at the television, or were you the kid who drew attention?
No. I happened to luckily live in California, where everything, you know, was and pretty much is filmed, and everywhere my parents went, people would, you know, approach them and mention and getting agents. And, you know, I have a fraternal twin sister. So back then we were two cute little blonde girls, and people would come up and say, oh, they should be on television. So my parents talked about it and, you know, made an appointment with an agent. And then a week later, I think I booked my first commercial. So I'd done a few commercials, including one with Ronald Reagan before Bewitched. And then they started looking for a Tabitha.
Mm. Now, during the time that you were on that show, they also, if I'm not mistaken, during that time, they also changed Darren's, right?
Yes. I worked 3 years with Dick York and 3 years with Dick Sargent.
What was that like for you at that tender age, all of a sudden this switch of the person who's playing your TV dad?
Yeah. Well, it wasn't my real dad. That would have been more confusing. But Dick York had been sick for a long time. He'd hurt his back early in his career. And, you know, even as a child, I knew that he was in pain. And one day he had a seizure on set. And after that, they had to replace him. They'd done, you know, I think 10 episodes his final season without him, where they kind of wrote around the Darren character altogether. And, you know, it got to the point he just couldn't work anymore.
What was it like being the TV daughter of Elizabeth Montgomery?
It was great. Absolutely great. She was a lot of fun. It's funny because her children are still great friends of mine, and I stayed close with her husband, Bill Asher, until he passed away recently. But almost everyone in my life says I'm more like Elizabeth Montgomery even than my own parents. And maybe it's because we spent so much time together on the set, but she was someone I loved and admired very much.
As I mentioned, you've done so much still within the industry through your adult life, from teenagehood right through until your adult years. Was there a period of time where you didn't want to be in the entertainment business, or was this something that was always your love and passion?
You know, I think it's since I grew up on a TV set, I feel really, really comfortable on a TV set. So I don't know. I mean, I've done so many different things in the business, and people have continued to offer me, you know, jobs in the business. And now I act and I'm a host and correspondent. And also, I have a big ranch in California that we use as a filming location. So, you know, I'm filming a movie there tomorrow. We filmed a movie there last month. We're constantly filming. And it's one of those things where I think it might bug people, the chaos of a set, but I love it.
Is there anything in acting or anything in the business that you've wanted to do that you still haven't had the chance to do?
Oh, of course. Absolutely. I think one of the things that I don't regret doing is that I specifically stepped back from acting when I had a family. That's when I started doing hosting work and, you know, pitch person and correspondent work, because it was in radio. It's one of those things where I could work fewer hours, still make, you know, good money, but be home with the kids, because I didn't want to, you know, a nanny or someone else raising my children. And it's something that I learned from being on set. I was there with Elizabeth Montgomery and Dick York when their kids weren't. And I've never, ever known an actor to say they wish they'd worked more when their kids were young. So I made the decision, you know, I kind of walked away from series work. So one of the things I'm kind of talking about now, Nick, this year, starting 2014, is the 50th anniversary of Bewitched. And my youngest is just turning 11. And, it, you know, it's a time I'm going to start doing some acting jobs again. So it's kind of a big year for me.
Mm. Was there ever a time, again, spending so much time on set, I know there's a certain amount of hours a child actor can work, but still, it's more time than the average person spends on a set. And being around the cast and the crew, is there any difficulty, or was there any difficulty after 6 years of doing this, of saying goodbye? I know you kept in touch with some people, but saying goodbye to what is essentially a secondary family for you?
Right. It is difficult. And unfortunately with Bewitched, we never had a big goodbye party. We were never canceled. We went, you know, the series season 8 ended and we were all planning to come back for another season. We'd been picked up. And then during the hiatus, Liz Montgomery and Bill Asher decided not to do another season. So we didn't have the big goodbye party and get to say goodbye to all the other people on the set. So it was sad.
Mm. And you should mention, I guess a lot of people don't know that Elizabeth Montgomery and Bill Asher were husband and wife.
Right. Until the show ended. Then the show ended and their marriage ended. So that had a little bit to do with it.
Mm. Now, Dick York was Darren and Dick Sargent was Darren. And then you married a Darren.
I did. It took a while to find a Darren.
Do you, even though it's 50 years since the show first went on the air, do you still get recognized as Tabitha?
All the time. Shockingly, all the time. And I don't know if it's because I've done things on television since, but I'm recognized almost every day. Which is a compliment. I was cute.
What, again, from your earliest memories, what was the hardest thing for you to grasp or understand about what you were doing in your role as Tabitha each week?
Actually, that's funny thing is, I think the hardest thing for me to grasp is there were so many episodes where I didn't do very much. It's like, Tabitha, go upstairs to your room. Tabitha, go. I always wanted to do more. So that part was hard for me. I liked when the scripts would come every week and there'd be lots of highlighted parts for me. Those are my favorite weeks.
Now, besides being in the business, you also started other businesses. You have something called Erin Murphy Knits?
I do. I'm interested in crowdfunding. So I'm in the process of writing a book on Kickstarter and crowdfunding. So I launched my own project last year and had a project funded through crowdfunding. So it's something where I have a ranch, I raise alpacas, I have a small knitwear company called Erin Murphy Knit. So it is an actual company that I have, and it's something that, you know, I take care of alpacas daily and knit regularly. But it was kind of moving forward towards the business of writing the book on crowdfunding and Kickstarter.
Mm. Working as a child actor, especially at a time when, you know, you were on sets where other television shows were nearby, did you ever hang out with other kids who were either on your show or on other shows?
One thing that's very funny about that, I would see child actors when I was a child actor, but I didn't play with them. I mean, I went ice skating with the Brady Bunch and things like that, but as an adult, I'm friends with every child actor you could ever name. Seriously, every single child actor is a friend of mine. We had a big party at my ranch a couple months ago, and everybody was there. So, I mean, it's like it was kind of a who's who from Kitty TV. We're all friends.
That's kind of nice to hear.
It sounds unbelievable, but it's true.
You know, it doesn't sound unbelievable, and it also has a fraternity and sorority there that most people probably would not understand or get.
It's absolutely true. We have a group, and we're called the Secret Society of Child Actors, and we're all friends because we have kind of common ground. I mean, we share life experiences that other people wouldn't understand. So, you know, people like me and Brady Bunch and Little House on the Prairie and the Waltons and all those shows, we grew up in a way that most people don't understand, and it's like we automatically bond over that.
Well, it's good to hear that everything is working out so well. And again, you're just so busy. People can go to your website and find out more information, correct?
I'm very, very Googleable. If you Google Erin Murphy, you'll learn more than you could ever want to know about me.
And there's a website, which is, I believe it's starwebsites.com/Erin Murphy.
That is. That's a mouthful, though. It's easy. Just Google it. Then all you have to do is click the link.
Okay. Erin, thank you so much for being on the program with us. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you. It's great talking to you, too.
Actress Erin Murphy, better known as Tabitha on the classic TV series Bewitched. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0229, and you'll find links to Erin's website.
You're listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander Show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of the Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick. If you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
You're experiencing the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Sit back, relax, let it rattle around between your ears, tickling your cerebellum, and enjoy.
And still to come in the program, we'll talk about sports gambling and game fixing. Plus, Peter Franklin, the Gabby Cabby, joins us. And of course, there will indeed be an Idiot of the Day on a program also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Right now, more Stuff File news. Rodney Roturt of Tulsa, Oklahoma, filed a lawsuit recently against Philadelphia insurance companies demanding the return of his classic 1967 Chevrolet Camaro, supposedly worth about $100,000. His case is complicated by the fact that he also recently pleaded no contest to possessing stolen property, i.e., the very same car stolen from an Arkansas dealer in 2007. Roturt claims he bought the car legitimately, but he also changed the vehicle identification number to obtain a false title. Roturt said his legal claim, especially with the current VIN, is superior to the insurance company's claim. Wow. Has this guy got a brass pair on him or what? I mean, talk about chutzpah. Seriously. Meanwhile, police finally arrested 55-year-old William Footman in October as the person who somehow managed to swipe inside front doormats from at least 37 New York City banks between March and May of 2013. No money was ever taken, and some banks were slow to realize the thefts, unobservant that they had even had front doormats in the first place. "I sell them to bodegas," Footman said. "Their floors get wet." Sounds like the ultimate Robin Hood, doesn't it? Yeah. Anyway, moving right along, there seems to be more than one or two bizarre divorce cases in Kuwait. A Kuwaiti woman filed for divorce from her husband, citing the shocking sight of seeing him using bread to eat his peas, according to court documents. A Kuwaiti daily said the court heard the woman was disgusted by the shocking sight of her husband using his bread instead of a fork to eat his peas and decided his poor table manners were grounds for divorce. The filing followed another divorce where a woman told the court her husband insisted on squeezing the toothpaste from the middle instead of the end of the tube. "We were always arguing," she was quoted as saying. "I kept telling him that he should squeeze at the end of the tube, but he stubbornly refuses and keeps squeezing it in the middle. He is so obstinate." Another recent divorce involved a man deciding to divorce his wife because she refused to bring him a glass of water, saying it was the job of their domestic helper to do that. A Kuwaiti legal expert says divorces in the country often result from couples being unable to accept one another's habits. The expert said couples should take time to get to know one another prior to their marriages so they avoid unpleasant surprises later that could lead to divorce. And, that part of the world is different from elsewhere. How? In this regard? Yeah. Anyway, an army officer stationed in North Carolina revealed pictures of Gingerbread, a replica of Osama bin Laden's compound made from gingerbread. The Fort Bragg stationed intelligence officer, who asked to be identified only as Steve so that I don't limit my career options, he said, posted pictures on Twitter of his scale model of Abbottabad, Pakistan, the compound that sheltered the terrorist leader until he was killed by Navy SEALs in 2011. Some people on Twitter said that's the most delicious sand table ever, and essentially that's what it is, Steve said of his creation. He said he used 4 pounds of dough and it took him several days to assemble the resulting 63 pieces of gingerbread into a replica of bin Laden's compound. "It almost felt like an operation," he said. "The research took a few days. I hemmed and hawed for a day or two over the scale and process. The baking took place in one day, and all the assembly took place in one night." Steve said the replica includes plastic army men and a model UH-60 to represent SEAL Team 6 and their crashed Black Hawk helicopter during the May 2nd, 2011 attack on the camp. He said there is still some work to be done before the project is completed. "To the east of the main house, there's a garden where I understood bin Laden would walk," he said, revealing the garden would be made from coconut. "I'm probably going to break up the UH-60 model a little bit for the crash." Okay. This is either a really, really talented guy or a guy with too much time on his hands, or both. Anyway, finally in this section of Stuff File News with me, Peter Anthony Holder, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program, an unnamed woman was walking along a bay in Melbourne, Australia, and checking Facebook while she walked. You know where this is going, don't you? Yeah. She was distracted enough to walk off the pier and into the water. A witness called for help and police arrived to find her still in the water, flailing about 65 feet from the pier. She was still out in the water, lying on her back in a floating position because she told us that she couldn't swim, said Senior Constable Dean Kelly of the State Water Police. She still had her mobile phone in her hand. The woman, who police quickly pointed out was a foreign tourist, was taken to a hospital. With Facebook or social media in general, as far as we're concerned, if you're anywhere near the water, just pay attention, Kelly said. Wow. Like you need to say that. Anyway, thankfully, no one ever does this near heavy traffic or train tracks and thus don't need the warning for that, right? 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 Yeah. Let's get to our next guest, shall we? When it comes to sports, there is a lot of betting going on, and where there's betting, there's the opportunity to have organized crime involved and sports fixing. On the line with us right now is Brian Toohey, who is an expert on game fixing and the author of Larceny Games, Sports Gambling, Game Fixing, and the FBI. He joins us via Skype-to-Skype communications from Wisconsin. Hi, Brian.
Hi, how are you doing, Peter?
I'm fine. Thanks for being on the program with us. I want to start right off by talking about the subtitle of your book. I find it interesting. Sports Gambling, Game Fixing, and the FBI. Where does the FBI come into this?
When I wrote my first book titled The Fix Is In, right when I was finishing it, I discovered that the FBI had numerous files related to investigations into what they call sports bribery, which relates to the Sports Bribery Act, which was passed in 1964, and that basically made it a federal crime for anyone to bribe a player, a coach, or referee to alter the outcome of a game. So I used the Freedom of Information Act and obtained every single file the FBI had related to that information.
Okay. So what did you find?
Well, what I found I thought was rather shocking is in the course of about 20 years or so, the FBI conducted well over 400 investigations into game fixing here in the United States, and that covered horse racing, boxing, college sports, and the NFL, the NBA, and Major League Baseball. And when you consider that the NFL, for example, says we've never had a game fixed ever, I think this information that the FBI possessed would say otherwise.
So who exactly is involved as far as you're concerned? I mentioned in the introduction organized crime. Is it just more than that?
Well, I think organized crime has a big element in it. Can you consider the fact that no one really knows how much money is gambled illegally in the United States each year? The best estimate we have really ranges from $80 to $380 billion. And that's a ton of money. And all of that is going into organized crime's control. They run the illegal sports gambling underworld in this country. So they clearly have enough money if they wanted to influence games to do so. And there are mobsters out there who claim to have influenced games. And so you have to wonder, well, if they can do it, why can't other gamblers do it? Why can't other people do it? And when you look around the world and you look at soccer and tennis and cricket and see that there are syndicates out there that are fixing games in those sports, we have to question what's going on here in the United States.
Is there any one particular major league, as far as you're concerned, that should be more worried or is of more concern than others?
I think all of them should be highly concerned. And to me, that's one of the problems is there's no transparency, especially within the NFL, the NBA, Major League Baseball. They all have billions upon billions of dollars gambled on these sports. They all have their own security divisions, which are staffed with former members of the CIA, the FBI, and likewise. And yet we never hear anything about any corruption coming from these entities. And we never hear about what's really going on in the underworld of sports gambling.
So are you saying then that they're perhaps finding stuff and suppressing the news of it, or they're turning a blind eye to it? Which one?
I think both, to be honest. I think they do investigations. I know they do investigations. In fact, I've been investigating a Major League Baseball investigation over the course of the past 9 or 10 months now, which I hope to make public with a writing partner of mine in the coming year. But I think there's a lot of times when I've heard from gamblers and other people who will send me like emails and anonymous tips and that sort of thing that say, hey, they should be looking at this game, they should be looking at that game, some strange things happened. And it's not just because of some gambler losing their bet because they thought they were so smart. It's because it's legitimate information and it's legitimate strange occurrences within the sports gambling world. And like I say, because there is no transparency and you don't know what these leagues are doing, I think in many ways they're ignoring the problem.
Your book, Larceny Games, Sports Gambling, Game Fixing, and the FBI. Since your book has come out, what kind of reaction, if any, have you received from either people within the offices of Major League Sports or maybe athletes or even broadcasters and sports writers themselves?
Well, it's interesting that I'm the only person who's written a book on this subject matter in probably over 20 years. The last book that I know of was called Interference, which came out in 1989. And yet, despite writing this book and despite actually having a story from the book about members of the New York Knicks shaving points for their cocaine dealer back in the early 1980s, which was in the front page story for the New York Post and then was picked up and went viral, not many people are willing to discuss the subject matter. It's like there's too much money involved. There's too much of the, you know, NBCs and the ESPNs and the Sports Illustrateds that not only thrive because of the sports leagues, but actually fund the sports leagues, that I think they don't want to touch the subject matter because if fans get in their heads that there's a potential that some of these games have been fixed for whatever reason, well, then it affects the legitimacy, it affects the league's integrity. And then people, they're afraid, I think, will tune out and stop watching, and that will affect everybody's bottom line.
How difficult is it to fix a sport when you're talking about multiple entities? I mean, you talk about, for instance, fixing a sport like earlier you mentioned tennis or boxing, a one-off where a few people are involved on one particular side. But when you're talking about an entire team, how easy or difficult is that to pull off?
Apparently, it's not as difficult as many people would believe. If you look at soccer, and soccer is the world sport. It's the biggest sporting event out there, the World Cup, for example. That has been fixed. Games within the World Cup have indeed been fixed, and it's undeniable that this has occurred. And if you can get to soccer players, if you can get to soccer referees, and you can influence that game, and I find that game even more difficult to fix than something like the NBA, where you only have five players, and if you have control of one player, you have 20% of the team, or one referee who can easily change the outcome of a game. If you can fix soccer, and we know literally hundreds of soccer matches around the world have been influenced, then you can get to anybody in any sport, I think. And I think the way they do it is, it's not necessarily what people believe, that, you know, they're greedy athletes or these organized crime guys are hanging out. I think it's players who have gambling problems, players who have drug problems or alcohol problems, and they just get into the wrong crowd and they get into trouble, and then the right kind of people come along and they pick up on that and then turn those players into influencing games for them.
Does it become more difficult to pull this off in an era where more and more and more information is available, more cameras are everywhere showing exactly what a player did from literally every angle? Is it becoming tougher, or is it always the same as it has been?
I think it's the same as it always has been. I think, you know, it's one of those things where, like, in the Tim Donaghy case, who was an NBA referee who got busted by the FBI for gambling on games, many people assume that he fixed games, that this referee clearly altered the outcome of certain games. And the FBI was aware of this information. The NBA was aware of this information, but they didn't pursue it. They didn't try to convict him of game fixing because they knew they couldn't watch game film and say specifically, well, he made that bad call on purpose, or he made that correct call on purpose because of his gambling. And that's the problem, is you can look at a game, you can look at a player, but you can't say, you know, everybody has a bad day. You know, a guy could drop a pass just because he dropped a pass. You know, a guy could throw the ball out of bounds just because he made a, you know, bad throw. Those things happen. So to say specifically that somebody did this on purpose, you have to have more information behind it. And that's the problem with game fixing, is there is no concrete information. There's no evidence. And that's one of the things I bring up in the book through these FBI files, is that they didn't have the concrete evidence they needed to get convictions in many of these cases because there was no such evidence to be found.
In writing this book, Larceny Games, Sports Gambling, Game Fixing, and the FBI, whom are you trying to reach the most? The sports fan who doesn't believe this, the games are being fixed, the sports fan who wants more questions asked, or the leagues themselves who you feel should be more transparent in what they do?
Well, in my own mind, I'm just trying to take the leagues to task because I don't believe they're doing all they could be doing in terms of the subject matter. I don't think they're being honest with fans when they're fighting this fight against legalizing sports gambling, because I think if you legalize sports gambling, there'd be much more oversight on both the leagues and the gambling operations in this country, and we would find more fixes like they do in Europe, and we would be able to get convictions and get some of these negative influences out of the game. But at the same time, I mean, it's really written for fans, because there's a lot of sports fans out there that have contacted me over the years that say, you know, something's just not right with these sports. And I'm trying to provide them evidence to say, you're right. There are things that are clearly wrong with sports and more needs to be done. And I think the fans can have a huge influence on the sports leagues if they want to, if they're willing to walk away from the games because they question their integrity. Well, then that'll affect the sports bottom line. And just like steroids, when so many people got upset with steroids in the games, they turned around and did something about the subject matter. If more people did that in terms of gambling and game fixing, then I think you would see more transparency and more things occurring within these sports.
The book is called Larceny Games, Sports Gambling, Game Fixing, and the FBI. It's written by Brian Toohey. Brian, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
No problem. Thanks for having me, Peter. Anytime.
Brian Toohey, author of Larceny Games, Sports Gambling, Game Fixing, and the FBI. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0229, and you'll find links to Brian's website and also links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. As we begin a new year, let's look back at what may be the most unusual lawsuit of the past year. A Florida law firm that specializes in filing personal injury lawsuits was instead sued by a potential client after his chair collapsed in their office and he was injured. The man had gone to the firm's office to discuss how to sue someone else. Later in court, the man's expert witness argued that chairs should be tested every 6 months. The personal injury law firm, however, said that the only way to test chairs is to actually sit in them. Well, the Florida Supreme Court ruled against the law firm, and now it owes the man about $700,000. Let's be fair, the irony of this lawsuit is obvious, but the consequences are far-reaching. Now every business in Florida, or anyone there who owns a chair, could be liable in similar lawsuits if they don't inspect their chairs every 6 months. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamerica.org.
Latitude, 47 degrees, 14 minutes north. Longitude, 84 degrees, 39 minutes west. Location, Montreal, Canada. This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Now, the Stuff File presents the Gabby Cabby, direct from his yellow mobile conveyance lounge in the city that never sleeps, New York. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And with a brand new year, we do have Peter Franklin, the Gabby Cabby from New York City. Hello, sir.
Hello, hello. Live from the exciting streets of New York City.
There's a storm going on as we speak. Winds are blowing. But there's also the winds of political change taking place in your city. You've got a new mayor.
Yeah, it's a complete 180% turnaround. Now, I don't know how much of it is just hype. Our former mayor, Mayor Bloomberg, was fairly conservative, ran the city like a business, and didn't do that much for the poor and the oppressed. Now, this new guy, de Blasio, in his running for office, said that he was going to do everything for the poor, depressed people. His position of his people was that New York City has been a plantation. That's kind of interesting. I'm not quite sure what he meant by that. But the fact of the matter is, he's promised to tax the rich and give away all the money to the poor. But like I say, I don't know where it's going to go. So for the moment, on paper anyway, we've gone from sort of right-wing conservative to tree-hugging commie pinko liberal.
Quite the shift.
Well, you know, but it's the same thing in a sense with our president, because most people don't seem to realize that President Obama gets most of his funding and his campaign money from Wall Street. So he also, like all politicians, talk a good game. When it gets down to the nitty-gritty of actually running the city, the state, or the country, all the promises and all the philosophies go flying out the window. So I don't think it's going to be any different for the average person in New York City with this new guy.
I mentioned at the beginning that there's a bit of a storm taking place, and there's a lot of snow and cold in your neck of the woods, as there is in mine, and most of the Northeast, and certainly up here in Canada. What's it like for you as a cab driver? Is it easier, more difficult? Do you spend as much time on the road? What?
No, it's not really a problem in New York City, and the reason it's not a problem in New York City is that no matter how much snow falls after the initial shock, we have thousands of trucks that move the snow off the streets. They push it into big, huge piles where the snow is melted and sent down the sewers, because after all, it's filthy water. It's not something you can just dump in the ocean. So, you know, figure the first day, it's a bit of a mess, and you can go frolic in the snow and you can make a snowman. But the day after the snowstorm, it's over and done with. So you get a lot of media hype as to people getting stuck in the snow and people having this problem or that problem. I think in almost all instances, you could give each one of those persons a sign to put on their forehead that said, "I'm stupid."
Well, speaking of media hype, there's, a statue in New York City that's getting a lot of attention.
Yeah, especially from the New York Times. But, I mean, I'm not really surprised about that, because I think the Times in many ways is probably good to be a birdcage liner. But some artist lady was given $5,000 by the city to... I want everybody to listen very carefully to my description of the statue. There happens to be a picture of it, by the way, on my website, which is Gabby.com. But what she did is she made a statue of a man hugging, being hugged by a bear, And as a result of that, he has an erection. Now, I'm not quite sure into what category of art that goes, but so now here we spent $5,000 to get that statue, which is in a New York City public park.
Yeah, and
if I wasn't telling the story myself, I'd be saying, what did he just say?
And to be clear, just want to get the semantics right here, the man has the erection, not the bear, right?
Well, I'm not sure about that, because from the angle you can't see it. And plus the fact, the big unanswered question, is this a male bear or a female bear? Because if it turns out it's a male bear, there's an additional element in all of this. But the statue lady will not make any comment. But the New York Times, which obviously has a lot of space in its newspaper, chose to highlight it, draw everybody's attention to it. If you notice, I guess I'm drawing attention to it too, but I'm not telling you where it is. You know, if you want to find out where it is, go look it up. I'm not telling people.
Okay. Meanwhile, since it is the new year, I know I ask this question every year, and so I know the answer, but did you spend a wonderful evening in Times Square on New Year's Eve?
No, absolutely not. I mean, what my wife and I do, we have enough excitement in our lives that we have to have some quality time by ourselves. So we did what we do every New Year's Eve, especially now that the children are grown and out of the house. My wife makes a delicious party with all those little things you would have at a party, except it's just for the two of us. So it's kind of neat, because then you can fall over. You know, you get to eat all the franks and blankets you want and all the little canopies you want, because after all, we're the only people at the party.
That sounds like a really nice idea. I like that.
Yeah, it's a lot easier to clean up.
Absolutely. Now, one of the things about being in a big city is you kind of have to be good neighbors, and I understand that's not necessarily the case with one Roman Catholic church in Manhattan.
Yeah, I mean, I identify it as Roman Catholic, not because we're particularly Roman Catholic bashing. I think it could have been at any particular church or synagogue, I guess, for that. The guy, the priest was ringing the bells, the chimes, and it got very annoying, because after all, there's enough noise in the city already, and the neighbors kind of petitioned him to please do less ringing of the chimes. This was kind of during the Christmas season, and instead of doing less, he did it even more. So not only was he an uncaring priest, he was sort of like a spiteful priest. But, you know, there's a New York expression that when you do something to somebody else, you better be careful or they're going to ring your chimes. And that may happen to the priest.
Ah.
Somebody may just ring his chimes.
Meanwhile, getting back on the roads of New York, I understand that the NYPD has some new toys in their cruisers that can read a lot of license plates at a very quick rate.
Yeah, it's testing it out, and I mean, it's just going to be harder and harder to be a criminal, I guess. I think it's an ingenious idea. You know, cops can look at a license plate and kind of check it, and then look at a license plate, check it. That's a very consuming thing. To have a gadget, it's just in one police car right now, and it's software program, that all the cop has to do is point the gun, sort of like a checkout counter in a supermarket, at the plate, and in about 2 seconds, he can get a readout on the plate. And then if he puts it in the automatic mode, where he's not specifically targeting, you know, this car and that car, just as he drives down the street, the gadget will kind of pan the street, catching all the license plates, and then a little beep goes off, and he, of course, will slam on his brakes, and he'll find out why did this particular license plate set off the alarm, and it probably set off the alarm because it has outstanding tickets, or it's, you know, the owner is wanted for something. So, you know, anything you can do to stop crime is very, very good, because crime is not nice, especially if you're going to get hit, shot, robbed, mugged, and all that.
And a law-abiding person like you has nothing to worry about as far as license plates are concerned. You don't care about Big Brother, per se, do you?
Well, I don't have a problem, because the gang that I'm part of is the biggest, scariest gang in the city, so nobody would bother me.
Meanwhile, we touched on Neighbors a little while ago. I want to bring up another story about Neighbors. The New York City Probation Department has have moved to new facilities. How do the neighbors feel about that?
Well, they're contemplating in a very weird way, and I guess they just didn't realize what they were doing, is they were going to move the probation and parole headquarters from one building, which is in an area called Tribeca, and they're going to put it in the Wall Street area. Well, nobody realized until, of course, the word came out, said, wait a minute, the people in Wall Street, the brokers, don't want that element to be in their neighborhood. And I'm thinking to myself, what are they complaining about? Most of the prisoners on probation and parole will probably be their business associates from brokerage firms and banks. So it's going to make it convenient for them to leave their offices and just go next door to visit their former partner who's serving time. So I don't know. I think it's an ingenious idea. But the Wall Street community is fighting it because that goes back to the old thing. You know, I want all these social things done, but not in my neighborhood.
Mm. Meanwhile, before we let you go, I understand you do have a celebrity sighting for us. You actually saw a soap opera legend?
Yeah, and it was one of those encounters, it's Susan Lucci that we're talking about. It was one of those encounters, which is almost a little embarrassing. I mean, I saw her, and it was sort of like, oh, I didn't know she was still alive, which is, you know, kind of mean-spirited. But she has been around. I think she's probably been on television. I don't even know, by the way. You would know, because you're the master of all trivia, if she still is on the show. But I can remember 35 years ago was probably the first videotape machine that was ever made, my wife and I taping the show that she was on so that when we came home from work, we could see it. And that got to be at least maybe even 40 years ago. So, but she's alive and well, and she looks very nice for an older lady.
Well, first of all, she's not that old because she started in All My Children when she was 17. So she was very young when she started on that program.
All right, well, when I say that old, I mean, that makes it, she's probably like sick in her 60s.
Yeah, and a grandmother of four now. But her new show is...
Oh, maybe grandmother. No, I'm only kidding. She looks pretty good. There's a very degenerate kind of statement that is, and that's not coming from me because I'm happily married, but other men might say she can put her slippers under my bed anytime.
But she is in a new series, which is going into its second season, called Devious Maids, and it's a very, very funny show. So she is.
Oh, well, I'll look for it then.
She is very busy. Now, had you ever seen her before? Because I think one of the things people don't realize when they see Susan Lucci is she's a very tiny woman.
Matter, she's like a midget. As a matter of fact, I wanted to go up to her and ask if she, if is it true that she designs airplanes.
Why do you say that?
Well, my pet theory is that airplanes, commercial, you know, jetliners, are designed by dwarfs.
Okay.
I'm firmly convinced. I mean, I know this is taking us off on a different subject, but I'm firmly convinced that there's a factory someplace in Kansas where you have a lot of short people who come up with the ideas for the interior design of all our commercial jets. I mean, it's there someplace, I'm sure.
I'm sure you're absolutely correct. Peter, it's always a pleasure to have a chance to talk to you. People can check your website, and on that website, www.gabby.com, they'll see things like the picture of that statue you were talking about and other items that you delve into in the city of New York. I know it's belated, but Happy New Year to you and yours, sir.
And same to you, your family, and all your nice listeners. Bye-bye.
The Stuff File.
And we're just about out of racetrack for this edition of the Stuff File program. We have time for one more item, and that would, of course, be the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the Strange Things Adults Do. The Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
A woman at home alone in Los Angeles was alerted by her security system at 2:40 a.m. of intruders in her house. She looked at the system's cameras and saw four men with guns, and she called 911 for help. The gunman found her, but police, complete with a SWAT response, quickly arrived. One gunman fled and was immediately caught. Another hid in the backyard and was caught by a police dog. The two others begged the woman to tie them up and tell police that they were victims too. She tied them up and fled. She told police outside what had happened, but before they could go in to arrest them, they came out still tied up. Now, according to Officer Norma Eisenman, she said the two came out thinking that we were going to believe that they were victims also. She also went on to say, that's what you call felony stupid. Officer Eisenman, I couldn't agree with you more, because why would someone actually think that the victim of a home invasion is going to tell the cops that the invaders were victims too? One reason, and one reason only, they're idiots!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0229. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0229. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder, and don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded in iTunes and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it for this week's show. See you next time. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Before we go, we'd like to leave you with a helpful instructional message from the National Association of People Who Have Trouble Walking and Chewing Gum at the Same Time. Step, chew, step, chew, step, chew, step, step. Oh, God. I always screw it up.